Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Thursday morning, March 29th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a good show on the way for you today. It is our annual Final Four Fancast. So I was able to catch up with former Villanova point guard Ryan Archidiakono. I was able to catch up with former Kansas big man and former Survivor contestant Scott Pollard. And I also had a chance to chat with Rick Malnati, who is the son of Lou Malnati, who, as anybody from Chicago can tell you, is the founder of Deep Dish Pizza, quite literally, and also a former assistant coach under Porter Moser at Loyola Chicago. So it's a fun episode. I think you are going to enjoy it. Before we actually get into those conversations, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to the podcast. Any interaction that you can have with this podcast and the apps that you listen to podcasts in really does help us. It helps us with the metrics. It helps more people find it. It helps us get higher in those ratings. That's what advertisers like. That's what producer Tess likes. So if you enjoy what you hear on this podcast, the best way to give back and to help us out is just give us a rating. Throw a little five stars. Say something nice about me. Say something nice about Tess. Say something nice about Scott Pollard. Whatever you do, it really does help. I promise you that. And without further ado, let's get into that conversation with Rick Malnati. Now, let me welcome on Rick Malnati to the show. He is part of the family that has built a pizza powerhouse in Chicago, and he is also a former assistant and longtime high school coach in Chicago and with Loyola Chicago. So, Rick, before we get into basketball, I consider myself something of a pizza connoisseur. I'm from New Haven, Connecticut, home of the greatest pizza on the planet, outside of Lou Malnati's, of course. And I've always wondered this. How did deep dish become a thing, and why did it start in Chicago? Kind of take me through the history of that style of pizza, if you could.
Yeah, as crazy as it sounds, my grandfather was like the original guy at Pizzeria Uno in Chicago. And my dad was living in Italy. It was kind of one of those situations where you can't come to the mainland, and when you make it, you send for your family. So my grandpa was over here working for a guy named Ike Sewell at Pizzeria Uno. And when my dad came over to the country at 18, he started working right away in the restaurant business. And, you know, things just kind of moved and morphed into my dad opening up his own place in 1971. And then he passed away in 78. And it was kind of just left to me, my brother, and my mother, and kind of grown it you know, from that time till now.
I worked in restaurants for a decade before I started doing this whole sports writer thing full time. So I'm always curious about people that kind of grew up in that industry. What was your favorite part about being a restaurant family, and what was the toughest thing for you growing up?
Yeah, probably the toughest thing was when we opened up Malnati's. I was 12 years old in sixth grade, and we opened up on St. Patrick's Day. So I think from St. Patrick's Day, you know, throughout the rest of that year, I never went to school on time. You know, it was kind of a old school situation where it was a family business, and we would work. Me and my brother, who was 4 years older than me, would work every night at the restaurant. And the hardest part was that, you know, it was my dad's, you know, passion. And, you know, part of that passion was also sitting at the bar drinking. So, you know, he was gone a lot. You know, so kind of grew up, you know, with a dad that was starting his own business and trying to grind it out. And, you know, just the long hours. The best part was that it was unique. There was not a lot of pizza places around back then. You know, like now there's one on every corner. You know, back then, you know, we were the only game in town in a suburb north of Chicago. So just seeing how pizza's just transcended, and you know, how the Malnati name has taken off. And I mean, it's just a crazy story. It's unbelievable. We've been pretty blessed.
Now, was the pizza you guys made always kind of that thicker crust, that deeper dish, or did it just kind of evolve that way?
Yeah. No, always deep dish, always deep dish. So, you know, we kind of differ from the East Coast a little bit. It was always a knife and fork kind of thing.
Now, when you go and get deep dish yourself, what's your order? What's your favorite kind of pizza?
Yeah, that's changed over the course of my life, too. I think right now I'm a spinach and mushroom guy, you know, a little bit healthier. You know, I got married, and my wife's a vegetarian, so we stay away from the sausage. But, you know, the sausage is the classic pizza here in Chicago. But my kids kind of – my son's a big sausage guy, but everybody else is kind of going vegetarian on me.
Yeah, I'm a sausage guy as well. When I go, I always let the people that are from Chicago decide what we're going to eat when we go there. But and they always end up getting the sausage, and that's my go-to, man. That's my go-to.
Classic.
So you played basketball at Bradley, right? And while you were
I
there,
did.
I was told that you actually guarded Larry Bird. So one, how did that go for you? And two, is there anything about his game that people don't realize? Did he talk a lot of trash? Like, give me all the Larry Bird stories you got.
Larry was a great trash talker. In fact, I think my biggest memory, first of all, there wasn't a lot of film back in those days, so I thought Larry Bird was black, when I heard the scouting report on the guy. That's one thing. So, and he couldn't have been more white than he was. And then the other thing is, I'm sitting on the bench and he gets a pass on the, like almost at the hash mark, and he's out of bounds. And it was almost embarrassing to say he was out of bounds because he just caught it and shot it in. But they were great back in that day. And I did have a chance to guard him, but it was a little different. The coach at the time at Bradley was a guy named Dick Versace, who wound up from Bradley, wound up getting in the NBA for a while. And he was all about kind of getting publicity for Bradley. And so we played what was called a birdcage defense. So we had two guys guarding Larry all the time and three guys kind of in a triangle. So a couple of guys on Indiana State scored about 30, and Larry only had four because he only touched the ball twice. So that's what was the extent of me guarding him. It wasn't like it was a one-on-one match. It was way more, two guys just stay in front of him. Larry just kind of let the other guys go to work. So, but we did get publicity because we held him to, I'm sure, the least amount of points he ever scored in college.
That's funny. I remember Jimmy Patsos at Siena did that to Steph
Yeah,
Curry that
yeah.
I want to say his junior year when he was at Davidson. I didn't know that that was a thing. People actually do that.
Yeah, we lost, but we got headlines,
So you spent quite a bit of time coaching in the high school ranks in and around the Chicago area the last couple of years. Talk to me about the best Chicago kid that you've coached against, and who was the toughest guy to play against that maybe people don't realize was as good as he is.
Yeah, well, Chicago, has a history of having great high school basketball, and I'd say the kid that I thought dominated the high school game the most of, that I coached against was a kid named Jamie Brandon from King. I think he wound up going to Indiana out of high school, and I don't know how his career wound up ending, but the kid was just dominant. He was about a 6'3" guard that could just do everything. And, back then, Sonny Cox and King were kind of like the, they had 2 7-foot. I mean, they just, kind of owned Chicago basketball for a while. But he was the best. I remember, and I coached against. We played against Corey Maggette, and he was probably the best athlete. He could just fly.
So the real reason I have you on here is that the staff that you started on in college with Porter Moser at
Yeah.
Loyola Chicago is now in the Final Four. So let me ask you
Yeah.
this. Did you see it coming?
No. I mean, I don't think you could ever see it coming. And, Loyola, I mean, it is a complete miracle what's going on there. I mean, just 2 months ago, they'd probably have 1,500 people at their games. When we started, we were, the bottom of the Horizon League. In fact, when they went to the Missouri Valley, we were still the bottom of the Horizon League. So what Porter's done in the last 5 years is nothing short of a miracle. And, if you've ever been around Porter, and when I was around him, it was 1 degree of separation from the time that he had spent with Majerus. So it was like being, with Majerus at that time, and Porter took all of Majerus's stuff and brought it to Loyola. And I think recently he's kind of morphed into, I think when you're around a genius like that, you want to kind of do everything that that guy does, and you maybe lose your own personality a little bit, because the guy that you were with was so successful. I know I experienced that after being with Porter, and I went back to high school. I had a lot of Porter in me, and it took me time to remember who I was and then bring the best of Porter. I think that was the situation when I was with Porter at Loyola. He was, a lot of Rick Majerus, and I think, now he's morphed himself into the best of Porter and the best of Majerus. And you're not going to find a better coach than Porter Moser. I mean, he is on it. He's driven. I mean, he is the, you know, him and Matt Gordon are the only two guys that have been there, you know, on the coaching staff since, 7 years ago when he got there. But Porter is, he's great. I mean, for Loyola to keep Porter, it's going to be pretty hard, I think.
So you mentioned that Loyola would have like 1,500 player or 1,500 fans at their games. I've always thought of Chicago as, you know, a pro sports and a high school sports town. It's never really been a big college sports town to me. And I guess my question is, how much is the city kind of embracing this team? All of a sudden you have the biggest story in college sports in your backyard. And are they hopping on the bandwagon?
Yeah. And, you know, if you remember back a while ago, I don't know now how old you are, but, you know, DePaul was a great college basketball team in the city, and the city completely embraced them, and they'd be sold out every single game, and they got as much, and the Bulls were down then. And then last year, Northwestern, got huge backing from Chicago and from the nation as far as that goes. But what's going on now in Chicago? You know, the cool thing about Loyola is that it's in kind of a blue-collar neighborhood in Chicago. You know, it's in Rogers Park. And I just think it's just kind of has the, the whole feel of what Chicago's all about. You know, kind of, like the 85 Bears. You know, these guys just get along well. They have good personality. You got Sister Jean, that's getting all kinds of publicity. But it's just a neighborhood school. You know, it's probably like in New Jersey. I'm sure you got a couple schools like that that are Division I, you know, that don't get a lot of, a play in the New York, New Jersey sports media. You know, Loyola fit that bill. You know, didn't get anything, you know. And when I told Coach, I said, I went back to high school after a couple of years at Loyola. I said, there's more people that care about, you know, my high school team than care about Loyola. So, he's done an unbelievable job, and you know, there's been a lot of things that just turned out their way. You know, like they say, this is a God thing going on. How the chips have fallen for these guys, and how they've taken advantage of every opportunity. Plus, they really play the right way. I mean, you can't ask for a better group of kids.
Yeah, you mentioned Sister Jean, and I just want to ask you: is she as cool as she seems on TV?
Yeah, Sister. You know, when I saw her on TV, I hadn't seen her in a while, and seeing her in a wheelchair, I'm like, what is she doing in a wheelchair? I mean, this is a woman that would, you know, she'd delay the game by 10 minutes because she'd do the prayer over the, the loudspeaker before the game. I mean, she always was around campus, always involved with the kids. And she is, what you see is what you get. I mean, she's great. And what an ambassador for the school. But, you know, she fell and broke her hip, and that's the only reason she's in a wheelchair. I guarantee you, you know, next year, if they're in the NCAA tournament, she'll be walking around.
Now let's talk about the actual game itself. What does Loyola have to do in your mind to be able to beat this Michigan team?
Yeah, you know, I mean, this is Michigan's legit, you know, but the one thing I think you like is, you know, Michigan plays, not that they're, 100% pattern, but they pretty much play patterns, and Loyola guards patterns well. When you go freelance and you start, getting over athletic on them, like you saw, I think at times in that K-State game, when K-State just, got out of their pattern, just started driving it. Even when Nevada got out of their stuff, it just started driving it. That was a little harder for Loyola to contend with. But if you run patterns, Loyola's going to guard you. I mean, they're going to be the best prepared team. If you go in the locker room before the game at Loyola, every single set and play that this team runs will be written up on, big paper, all over the place. So they'll be on all that. The hard part, I think, is, some of the matchups, as good as Krutwick is, the center for Michigan can extend you and go by you. He's really skilled, and I think they need Krutwig to play, at least half the game because he is such a great passer. And when he gets out on the perimeter, it just opens up so much stuff for Loyola. But Michigan's a pretty talented team. If Michigan doesn't shoot it well, Loyola's got a great chance of advancing.
All right, prediction time, man. Is Loyola going to cut down the nets on Monday night?
Wow. I hope that they get there and, you know, that they get a chance to play Monday night. It would be hard to see. I mean, that other side of the bracket is just ridiculous. And, you know, those two teams are, you know, those guys have so much more ability and size and athleticism. But I wouldn't count Loyola out. I'll tell you that. If they're not cutting down the nets, they're covering the spread, you know. You know, they're gonna outperform whatever you think they're gonna do. They're gonna outperform that, and you know, this is a big stage, and those other teams are a little bit more used to this kind of stage than Loyola is. But Loyola hasn't flinched yet, and I'll say one thing: they'll be prepared. You know, they'll be prepared. Porter's gonna do a great job getting those guys ready.
All right, the last thing I have for you, Rick, then I'll let you go. My colleague at NBC Sports, Scott Phillips, told me that your Fenwick High School team is pretty good, so I'm going to open the floor to you and let you brag about them a little bit.
Yeah, we've had some really good kids come through Fenwick in the last few years, and right now there's a sophomore, DJ Stewart, that's you know, a top 25 player in the country at shooting guard, and really talented kid, really good kid. And you know, if he puts on a little bit of muscle, you know, he's got a chance to be playing in a weekend like Lyle's playing in, right now this weekend.
Rick, I appreciate the time, man. Thank you.
Okay, great. And you know, make sure that you're eating that deep dish pizza when you get snowed in New Jersey. Can't live on that thin stuff. Can't live on that thin stuff out there.
We don't have any of that out here, man. It's all that thin crust pizza. It's all we got.
Okay. All right. Well, take care. Good luck.
Appreciate your time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Now let me welcome on Ryan Archidiacono, the former point guard for Villanova and current point guard for the Chicago Bulls. I believe I have that right. So let me start with this, Arch. The last time we saw Villanova in a Final Four was when Chris Jenkins hit the most famous shot in the history of college basketball. You had the assist on that play. And every time I watch the highlight, I can't help but notice that it looks like Chris is yelling for the ball the second after he inbounds it to you. So how loud was he? How many times did he scream for the ball? And just kind of take me through making that pass.
He definitely wanted the ball. He's a big-time player and made a big-time shot. As soon as he inbounded the ball, I was trying to make a play for myself and my teammates, and I heard him just say, arch, arch, arch. Kind of when I crossed half court and he had his hands ready and I saw him out of the corner of my eye and just flipped it to him, just trusting that he would make the shot, and he did. I don't know if people believe me that he was like the only voice that I heard on the floor, but I really, really only heard his three words of arch, 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 calling for the ball in front of 75,000 people, and thank God it went in.
What were you thinking when the ball was in the air?
Anytime Chris shoots, I always think it was going in. So I was like, that's good. He got an open look. It was a little deep, but I see he held his follow through and kind of I was trying to like get back and I had a good view, good angle. So I thought it was going in. Like I said before, Chris is a spectacular shooter. And anytime he shoots it, I thought it was going to go in.
Do you ever find yourself thinking like, man, that could have been me. I could have been the one that won the game for us at the buzzer.
Yeah, well, before we even got to our timeout, after Marcus Paige hit the shot, my first initial reaction was, man, I'm going to hit the best shot in college basketball history. So I wanted that shot, and I definitely thought that I could make it, but I just had to make the right play for my teammates because that's what they expected of me, and I'm so happy that I made that play. And do I wish it would have been me? Yeah, I mean, that would have been cool, but I'm glad the way we won it the way we did, just because I think it exemplified what Villanova basketball is all about, and trusting your teammates and being the best teammate you can be. And that's what we were till the very end.
And you still got a ring too.
Yeah. So that's not bad. I'll take the W anyway it came. I could have been sitting on the bench and someone else could have made the pass, made the play. I would have been ecstatic too.
So I actually heard a pretty funny story about your recruitment to Villanova and how it started. So I guess at one point you took an unofficial visit to campus for a dinner or something like that, and Jay Wright was in the room and he was making the rounds at the tables and never actually made it to your table to say hello. Did that happen? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, that was so I was a freshman, either going to be a freshman or going to be a sophomore in high school. And it was like for their Hoops Mania, which is like the Midnight Madness of every team. that they kind of do. We just call it Hoops Mania. And I was there and kind of, I was a younger recruit, so he's got to kind of talk to all the other recruits and everything. But he never made his way over to the table. Jason Donnelly, former assistant coach, now works at Villanova, was kind of talking to us a decent amount. And it just kind of was like a weird, like awkward experience for me, because I was like, all right, can we just leave if he's like not going to come say hello? But that's all in the past now. It all worked out for the better.
Do you ever remind him about that? Like, hey, man, I won you a national title and you didn't even say hello when I came to campus?
No, of course not. We only think about the good things, and we think about all the tough times we had my freshman year, and even losing early in the tournament sophomore, junior year, and all the guys that we had, and just fighting through adversity. But once we have a beer or something later on in life, I'll be sure to mention that.
So you grew up a Villanova fan, right?
Yeah, for sure. All those teams in the mid-2000s with like Nardi, Lowry, A. Ray, Frazier, and Sumter, all those teams.
Who was your favorite Villanova player? Like, who was the guy that you had the jersey on the wall?
I don't know if I had the jersey on the wall, but I loved Kyle Lowry. I mean, just the way that he was a competitor. He got in your face. He was a tough-nosed dude from Philadelphia. I admire the way he played, and I still admire the way he plays now in the NBA. Every time I go back to Villanova to work out, he's already done his workout at whatever time, 6, 7 a.m., so he's definitely someone that you can look up to, and I've always admired the way he plays.
Have you had a chance to play against him in the NBA yet, in an NBA game?
Yeah, not matchup wise. I mean, I was up, but I didn't play. So it was good, though. I mean, it's good to talk to him. I was talking to him before and after the games, and we played him in Toronto and then in Chicago for the next game. But it's all good. Kyle's he's really, really a smart basketball player and an even better person. So look up to him for sure.
Before we get into this specific Villanova team, let me ask you this. You're getting minutes in the NBA now. So what has been the most surprising thing about the NBA game for you? And what do you think the public's biggest misconception about NBA basketball is?
I mean, I would say the biggest adjustment for me is just that every position is the best player like in the world. I mean, the point guards are so quick. They're so fast. Then you get switched onto a big. You're not going to be able to kind of front them and kind of keep them from getting the ball like you could in college. But there are so many good players throughout the league that it's you're not going to get an off night, regardless of if you're starting or if you're the last man on the bench. Even to that very last buzzer goes off, you're still going to have to play your best because it's such a cutthroat league. And something that the average fan doesn't understand is, like, they think that people and players aren't playing hard, but they are. They are. They're just so talented and so skilled that they can make tough shots and make plays look super easy on the court, which is it's really tough to understand until you're really, like, in the trenches and going through these practices every single day and even playing and watching. You just have a certain amount of respect for how good players are and how easy they make it look.
So the year before you got to Villanova, they finished, I think it was 13-19 overall. And you guys had a pretty good year as a freshman. I think you lost in the first round of the tournament. But then starting from that point, your sophomore year until now, I think you can make the argument that Villanova has been the best program in all of college basketball. So let me ask you this. What's the biggest difference in the program from when you walked into the door to what it was when you walked out the door? What was the biggest difference in your mind?
I think the camaraderie with the guys, we just had great chemistry. Even from my freshman year, there was kind of, we had some tougher relationships that we had to kind of mend together, and we eventually got everyone on the same page, and we got great guys to come in the recruiting classes after myself and Daniel. We got great high character basketball players who buy into the system of what Coach Wright was preaching. And they're just good teammates, and they come from great parents and great families. So I think it was just the camaraderie, the chemistry that we had. And I think you hear Jalen talk about it, and Dante and Mikhail, just the chemistry both on and off the floor with the players from when they walked in to even the current team. Dudes just generally like each other. They like playing for each other, and they like having one goal together, and they don't really care who gets the credit.
So let's talk about Jalen. What in your mind, I mean, you went up against him every day in practice for a year. What makes him so good, and what is it about the way that he plays? Because he's not like what you would call a layup line scout, right? Like he's not one of these guys with all the physical tools. So what about him makes him so effective and able to do what he does despite maybe some of those physical limitations?
He can beat you in so many ways. He's one of the smartest basketball players I've ever been with. And in my freshman year, he knew how to pick his spots on the floor. He knew when to be aggressive. And he just had that basketball mindset, that basketball background with his dad growing up. I think he knows the game in and out. He can shoot it. He can score it. He can pass and he can lead. So he's got all the tools and combinations to be a very, very good basketball player. And I got to see it on a daily basis. And it was great to be able to go up against him, even when he was a freshman and I was a senior, because he would give me his best effort every single day and I would give him mine. So we would definitely go back and forth in practice, but it was all for the better. And I think we saw how much better he got throughout from his freshman year to now, and how much better the team is. You can just see he's just a great leader on the floor and special basketball player he is.
When you see what Mikal Bridges is doing now and how good he has been this season, are you surprised? I mean, you saw him when he came in as a redshirt freshman. Did you think he was going to be able to get to this point?
Yeah, we all knew Mikal had some potential. I mean, his freshman year, he was a younger, kind of like a late bloomer type kid, so had the redshirt and kind of go through the daily grind of going up against a lot older kids than him, some juniors, some seniors, some fifth-year seniors in practice every single day. That made him tougher. We all knew Mikal had potential to become a very good basketball player. Did we see that he was going to be a top 10, top 15 pick? I don't know if anyone really, really, really thought that, but we all knew that he was capable of being something special. And I think he's just kind of put it all together these last 2 years, especially this year. Him and Jalen leading that team, he kind of leads them on the defensive end and get out in transition. And, knocks down some open shots, so he's pretty lethal out on the floor. And to have him and Jalen side by side with Dante, Eric, Phil, and Omari, it's pretty tough.
One of the more interesting things I think that Texas Tech coach Chris Beard said about Villanova before the game on Sunday was that you guys really only run four or five plays, and everything else is just kind of read and react, and you have certain concepts and certain actions that you try to get into, but there's not really set plays that you run. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, it's basically, I don't want to give away Villanova's our offense too much, but yeah, it's a lot of read and react stuff.
So how do you, let me ask you this, how do you develop that then? You know, when you want to be a better shooter, you go and make 500 jumpers a day, you want to be a better ball handler, you do the two ball dribbling drills and all that kind of stuff. So how do you develop the ability to kind of read and react what, you know, as teammates?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the chemistry. I think the chemistry off the floor helps just as much as it does on the floor. You kind of get to know guys. You maybe even go and work out together. But even throughout the summertime, when teams play pickup and when we play pickup at Villanova, the guys, they run the offense that they're going to run during the year. So even without the coaches, it's kind of just playing that spacing. The pickup's a lot different than just your average YMCA or local rec pickup, like where dudes just kind of jog up the floor, take the first shot. They're actually making the extra passes. They're actually jump stopping. They're doing all the little things to develop that chemistry. And it might look ugly and it might look great in the summertime, but we know throughout the year that they're going to get better and better and play the best basketball at the end of the year.
How much have you seen of Kansas this season?
Not much at all. I haven't really watched them. I watched the Kansas-Duke game. They look pretty good, though.
What was your takeaway and based off of what you saw, how do you think Villanova matches up with them?
I think it's going to be another grinded out type game. I see similarities between the team that we played in the Elite Eight, our championship run in 16. But I think that instead of playing two bigs, they have four guards with the one big, I think, Azubuike or something.
Yep.
So they have the guards around and kind of play similar to Villanova. I think it's going to be a good matchup, but I'm going to have to always go with my guys from Villanova because I think we've been playing four guards for so long and have that great chemistry. I just hope we can grind out a win. But I don't think it's going to be a run-and-gun type fest. I think it's going to be like not many, I think maybe we'll hit like 5 to 8 threes and not shoot it great. And it's just going to be like a mid-60s, high 50s, I want to say, game.
So let me ask you this then. If Villanova is going to end up making that run and winning the national title again, what do you think is the X factor? What do you think they have to do to kind of make that happen?
I think they just have to defend. If they defend like they have been these last few games, I think that regardless of what happens on the offensive end, I think they're going to be able to win. I think that's the big thing for them is to just defend and stay out of foul trouble, because we all know that they can light it up, and when they're making their shots, we'll beat teams by 20 and 30 even. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be tough as you go throughout the tournament, you play better and better defensive teams. And I think that we're not going to be able to knock down the same shots, but I do think that we'll be able to defend at the same level and even higher level and maybe hold these teams to under 60, and we score in the mid-60s, like I said before.
All right, give me your official prediction. Is Villanova going to win their second title in 3 years?
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think Villanova people would kill me if I didn't say that, but I truly believe that we have all the pieces for another championship run. I mean, I know it's going to be very tough. Kansas is very, very good, and Coach Self is a great coach, and they have their conference player of the year on their team and a lot of great pieces around him. So it's going to be tough, and I'm looking forward to watching it.
Ryan, I appreciate the time, man. Thank you.
Yeah, no doubt, for sure.
And now let me welcome onto the show Kansas alum and the host of the Planet Pollard podcast, which you can find on SoundCloud and on iTunes, Scott Pollard. Scott, what's going on, my man? How you doing?
Just living the dream, man. Everything's great.
So talk to me about this new podcast you got and tell me what it's all about. I'm always in the market for new podcasts.
Well, mine's a little different. I mean, everybody's got a podcast, and everybody says theirs a little different, but with my background of being in the NBA, being a Kansas alumni, as you mentioned, and I have the unique experience of being on reality TV. I was on the TV show Survivor. We cover a lot of different grounds. I don't stick to one subject by any means, and basically it just happens podcast to podcast, whatever I feel like doing. So some of them have sports in it. Some of them have no sports at all. I've interviewed some famous Survivor types. The one that just came out this week, I had the actor and screenwriter and director, and I think the guy's done everything there is to do in Hollywood, Michael Rapaport. He's been a character actor for many, many years and been around some of the biggest stars in Hollywood. And we kept it short, but it was interesting to hear some of his stories, and they didn't all make it into the podcast. But, yeah, so we just I guess I'm talking in the royal we. I just kind of do whatever I feel like doing. It's almost like therapy for me, because it's a way for me to get out some of the thoughts I've had, some of the stories I've lived, and really the impetus behind my podcast was some friends of mine were just like, you know, these stories, you need to share them. Like, we hear them, and we know you, we've been around you for years, and you think it's just, you know, it's just your life, which it is. But you got to share some of these things with the world. So that was kind of the impetus behind doing the Planet Pollard podcast. So I'm not telling all the stories right up front, but you'll hear them here and there throughout the podcast. And it's very listener friendly. We do 30-35 minutes. I try to do it in that realm, because people, you know, they hear these 2-hour, 3-hour podcasts, and I don't know who has time to get all the way through that. Plus, a benefit, I don't know if you can hear them right now, but a benefit of the Planet Pollard podcast is I tape it in my mother's basement. Sarcasm. but my cat Monkey is often caught howling in the background. He's right now, he's doing the same thing, so it's kind of funny.
Yeah, my I have a 2-year-old boxer pup that loves to be involved in every conversation that I am in, whether it's on a podcast, on a radio interview, or just, you know, talking with the wife or whatever. So I feel your pain there, man. I feel your pain. You said you have lots of stories, so I'm going to start you off with this. You did a season of Survivor. What was the craziest thing that you had to do on that show, and what percentage of that show was real and what percentage of that show was fake? I got to know.
Well, that's when it comes to like the questions I get from Survivor, the number one is what's the craziest thing you had to eat? Well, we weren't starving. The first 3 days, my tribe didn't get a fire going. Mostly we just, we're scared to not to boil the water so we could drink it. And I ended up just starting to drink the water because I was getting really dehydrated and I know my body pretty well. I haven't been a professional athlete. So I just started going to the well and drinking the water, even though we weren't boiling it because we didn't have a fire. So that was probably the craziest thing I did up to that point. But I didn't get any viruses or parasites or anything from it. So maybe I was lucky. But then after that, we started boiling the water, but then we just couldn't boil it fast enough. So I just went back to drinking it.
Seems healthy.
Without boiling. Yeah. So I guess I've either got a hearty constitution or I was just lucky. But no parasites. But I guess the craziest thing I did then was something that just didn't really make the cutting room floor. There was no cameras around. After the first challenge, we jumped in the water. We had to untie some ropes. Long story short, it was a very exhaustive challenge. It was the first one of my season 32, at Co-Rong. And I overdid it. And as I said, I hadn't eaten much besides coconut for 3 days, drank some coconut juice, sparingly water because I was worried about parasites. So I was overdone, starving, thirsty, dehydrated, and I knew it. And I overdid it trying to win the challenge. And during the puzzle portion of the challenge, I was sitting there pretty much blacked out, but nobody else could do the puzzle. And I had already overdone it for trying to do the physical parts of the challenge. And I was up there trying to help do the puzzle. And I actually, when I looked back at it, watching it on TV, I was actually being counterproductive. I was switching the puzzle from vertical to horizontal because I was seeing it completely different than my partner, Denny, who was trying to do the puzzle. And she was right. And I was like, wait, no, you've got it 90 degrees wrong. So I kept switching the puzzle pieces 90 degrees. And being completely counterproductive to what she was trying to do, and we might have won the challenge had I not been blacked out, basically just kind of standing there, not really seeing things clearly. But we went to medical afterwards, and this is the part that's kind of behind the scenes production stuff, but you go to medical before and after every challenge, and there's no cameras there. And I went into the medical, and I was like, they were like, how you doing? I said, I'm fine, but I need some water. And they're like, well, can't do anything for you. And, long story short, I needed water really bad, and I ended up having an issue. They had to hook me up to a blood pressure cuff. My blood pressure shot up. I passed out. They started pouring water, bottles of water on me. They appeared out of nowhere after I passed out, and I almost got evacuated after the first challenge, and that's a little-known story. Nobody really knows that one except my friends and family. I haven't really told that even on my podcast, so there's that one. So,
that took a turn I wasn't exactly expecting. I thought it was going to be a funny story, and here you are almost dying on a desert island.
Well, and it kind of answers your question. The other part of your question is what percentage of it is real? The surviving part is absolutely real, and I think I just kind of delineated that for you in a few different ways. The surviving part is absolutely real, and as we all know, if you watch reality TV and you think to yourself, it can't possibly be like that 24/7, well, it's not. They pick out the highlights. You're on camera almost 24 hours a day. And as I said, there's certain parts of the day that are, you know, medical or whatever that aren't on camera, but we're not allowed to talk. So there's no, no drama. Nothing happens during that time. We don't get to talk to each other. It's just cameras are off. So there's no discussion. We just basically don't look at each other and don't talk to each other. And it's short time throughout the day, but while the cameras are on, they're on. For most of every day. Well, who's happy every day? Everyone. Who's sad every day? Everyone. Who does dumb things every day? Everyone. Who does smart things every day? So they have plenty of footage to make each character look as much as possible in a way that is there. So the surviving part, absolutely 100% real. I lost 46 pounds in 28 days before I got evacuated, or not evacuated, but voted out of the game. So that was real. I didn't fake losing 46 pounds, and I had 46 pounds to lose. I gained it all back. but no, the surviving part is absolutely real. And then the drama that living with these people, and I say these people because I'm one of them. So I'm not above or below anybody on the show. But you know, when you sign up for reality TV, there's something wrong with you.
Fair enough.
yeah, there's no one. There's no one that can say differently and make me believe them. For you to voluntarily sign up to do something like be on the TV show Survivor, you've got to have something wrong with you. And for me, it was a challenge. It was a way to see if I could do it. It intrigued me. They approached me in 2010. I couldn't go back then. And in 2014, my personal life was in a better place, and I was able to participate. So it was a life changing experience. Ended up having a fourth child because of the TV show Survivor. So I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
Well, look at that. Good things come out of Survivor. How about that? Let me, before we actually get into just Kansas, I do have to ask you this, because your time in Sacramento overlapped with Jason Williams' time in Sacramento. And as a white boy that fancied myself as a basketball player growing up, I idolized that man. So I have to ask you, what is your best Jason Williams story, and was playing with him as awesome as watching him play was?
My best Jason Williams story is one time we were in a club that will remain unnamed in Minnesota. And at the time, Randy Moss was playing for the Minnesota Vikings. And we ended up sitting there, all of us together. There was a few other guys, myself, Jason, and Randy. And those two went to high school together. And they were the quarterback and the wide receiver in high school. And they played basketball together in high school. So they've known each other for a long time. And to hear these two West Virginia boys talking back and forth to each other, it was like dueling banjos. No one else understood a word they said. And they completely understood. It was totally like a different language. It was great. It was hilarious. We were laughing. But those two in the same room talking to each other and reliving those stories, we were all dying laughing. But both of them are so funny and such great guys. That's my favorite Jason Williams story. Playing with him now, I feel badly that no one, like, technology's changed and everything's on camera nowadays. But I feel badly for the basketball world that our practices weren't all filmed, because as amazing as Jason Williams was on the court during games, practices where he did things that weren't technically legal, but magical just the same. And to see him do the things in practice that he did was just an absolute treat. You just always had to have your hands ready, because you never knew where that ball was coming from. The things you saw on the court as a fan during games were amazing, and multiply that by two or three. I'm not going to say 10, because that would be exaggerating, but multiply those things by two or three, because there's no refs calling carries or travels or whatever. Talking about throwing the ball up in his jersey as a crossover behind his back, and then having it come out the other side. Now, you can't do that obviously in a basketball game in the NBA, but just an absolute magician with the ball, and the things he did in practice that were just absolute sleight of hand, magic tricks, that would blow people's mind. And I think that's why people are loving watching him. And I think he's in the big three or whatever, and he still plays once in a while. But it was truly one of my favorite basketball memories. And I've played with some of the all-time greats. Been teammates with LeBron. I've been teammates with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, Grant Hill, my rookie year. Rick Mahorn, Joe Dumars were up there in Detroit. I don't want to leave anybody out, so I'm not going to keep listing. But I played against some of my childhood idols and played with some of the all-time greats. And Jason was just an absolute magician with the basketball. And it's a shame that people don't get to see what he could do with it without a referee calling a travel here and there, because his style of basketball was truly innovative. And it was like jazz music, where it was just always changing, always manipulating, but always making a wonderful sound.
I think my reverence for White Chocolate in asking you about him instead of asking him about LeBron James is probably all you need to know. All right, so this Kansas team. Before we get into the actual team, I do want to ask you this about Bill Self. He is a guy that's always played two bigs. He's never really differentiated from that until the last couple of years. So how weird is it as a Kansas alum, as somebody that watched this Bill Self program growing to what it was, how weird is it to see? I mean, you also play for Roy Williams too, right? And he's always been a guy that's kind of emphasized that the two big men kind of style of play. So how weird is it for you to see them going full small ball like this? Four guards, fire up threes, Svi Mihailić as a power forward.
It's the nature of the game. The game of basketball, as I said about Jason Williams, is jazz music. It is always changing. There's no set. Basketball has been played differently every decade since the beginning, since the invention of the game. Dr. Naismith, looking at the game today at Kansas, where he coached his first basketball game and the first basketball game, would probably go, this is silly. I never intended this. Dr. Naismith invented the game to be something to keep the boys in shape, and this is his quote, kept the boys in shape between football and baseball season. That's all it was invented for. It was an indoor sport during the winter, keep the boys busy and keep them in shape. And so the way the game is played now is the way it is. And Bill is just with the times. He's adapting, and that's what his greatest strength is as a basketball coach, is he takes a roster, just like an NBA coach does, that constantly changes, whether it's this year, Billy Preston, who became ineligible, or just actually he didn't become ineligible. It just, the NCAA decided his transcripts were good. Then they said, no, they're not. But we're going to review it. And his family got tired of it. He got tired of it. And he ended up moving on. No big deal. Good for him. His family decided it was too long in the NCAA decision. But the point is, Bill had players come and go, just like all the top programs. You can't count on it. When you're recruiting the best players in the country out of high school every year, you're recruiting the one and done. So your roster changes over. You have turnover. The not to skip ahead, because I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but the teams like Loyola Chicago, the teams like Gonzaga, Butler, Purdue, some of the teams that they get guys for 3 and 4 years consistently. Those are programs now, and that was back when I played. Roy Williams, you mentioned him. That was a guy I played for, and you had consistency in the style of coaching and the style of play because you had juniors and seniors on the team every year. Well, that's not really the times now. So, of course, things are going to change. It's jazz music. The game is changing, and Bill is just adapting with the times. If he had two bigs, I promise you, he'd play two bigs, but he doesn't. We've got Udoka, who has been in foul trouble, a little bit injured, a little banged up here and there. But also not a good free throw shooter, not a guy you want in the game at the end of the game. DeSosa was in high school in December, and then all of a sudden he's playing for the Kansas Jayhawks in January. You can't really build a program or a low post game around those two guys, can you? So you play one of them, and you back the other one up, and you play small ball. Guess who the best team in the NBA is right now? Well, it's a team called the Golden State Warriors. Now, they're not playing great of late. They're banged up and all that, but they've kind of set the tone, haven't they? At the top of the game, you've got that team playing the way they are and dominating. So, yeah, it's following suit. The young players are going, well, I got to shoot threes or I'm not going to be in the NBA, because that's the way it works. So the game is changing, and always will, until there's more big men, and that'll come back. There will be another Shaquille O'Neal, maybe not to his standard, maybe not to his level, but there will be another dominant post player that can come in and command the ball, or he's going to give you 25, 30 points a game if nobody can guard him. And then you're going to have some other big guys that can come in and guard him. So the game is cyclical. It's evolving constantly. It's jazz music, and it's a wonderful thing to see. And the traditionalists that say, oh, it's better in my day or whatever. Yeah, there's points in time where things were better here or there, but it is what it is now. And I hate that phrase, it is what it is, but hey, we're here now. We're watching the game. Bill Self is at the top of college basketball right now. He just won 14 conference titles in a row, eclipsed John Wooden, the Wizard of Westwood. And he did it against a conference that had 7 teams, I think, make the NCAA tournament this year, maybe 8, I'm not sure. But 4 of them made the Sweet 16. That's not playing against St. Mary's Sisters of the Blind. That's playing against the best of the best. That's a tough conference. He's not rolling over the St. Mary's Sisters of the Blind programs. He's rolling over the big-time programs that are all making waves this year in the NCAA tournament. They did. He's ahead of his time, but he's also current in his time. And when the day comes that he gets a job from the NBA or an offer from the NBA again, because he's already had few, but when it comes and he finally ends up accepting it, it's going to be a sad day for KU. We'll move on. We were good before him. We'll be good after him, but we'll miss him.
I feel like I need to mention this because I haven't mentioned it yet, but you are actually going – podcasting is not the only media career that you're kind of embarking on. You're going to be doing color commentary for the Kansas-only broadcast at the Final Four this year, and if I read the press release right, you're going to be doing it with Rob Riggle as a sideline reporter. So I don't even know what to ask there, but it just seems like tossing it to Rob Riggle to go interview Bill Self on the sideline seems like a pretty ideal way to watch a basketball game to me.
Well, we both went to Kansas at a little bit different times. He's a little bit ahead of me at the University of Kansas. But, I'm not 100% sure, but I was told by my agent that he was the sideline reporter. And if it's in the press release, then that's what it is. But, I was told that, and Dave Armstrong, who has always been around the Big 12 and been a part of a lot of Kansas broadcasts, so I know Dave very well. They call it Team Cast. I guess they're bringing it back on TNT this weekend, Saturday and Monday. You see what I did there?
Yep, and, I saw what you did.
Villanova is going to be on True TV. Their Villanova focused broadcast will be on True TV, and obviously Michigan and Loyola Chicago before us. One of them will be on TNT. One of them will be on True TV, and then you'll have the regular, whatever you want to call it,
the Jim Nance broadcast for you traditionalists.
Yes, that one. That one's going to be on CBS for both of them, for the game and the late game on Saturday, and then the national championship on Monday. And then, I think it's a great idea because fans, some of them love the traditional Jim Nance and Bill Raftery and Grant Hill's in that box too. So I think some people love that, and that's great. And most people will be watching that, and that's wonderful. And then there's the fans that are going to be like the fans watching our broadcast. They're going to be like, you know what? I'd rather see if Scott Pollard blows up on air. I'd rather see Rob Riggle do something crazy as a sideline reporter and tell some great jokes and interview Bill Self. Are you kidding me? Rob Riggle interviewing? And if that's the way it ends up, again, I'm not 100% on that, but I know I'm doing it. Dave Armstrong is great. I've wanted to work with him for a long time. In fact, I think I have worked with him in the past. It might have been a long time ago, so I'm forgetting. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun for the Kansas fans. Obviously, all four teams have their own fans broadcast. It's fun, and it gives the fans a different angle and something to look forward to. That's like, hey, you know what? If you're a Kansas fan, you can tune in, listen to Kansas guys talk about Kansas basketball. And it looks to be an interesting way to watch a game. And I'm very honored and excited to be the one that's doing the color analysis for the Kansas broadcast.
My favorite thing about that is when you look on Twitter and see the people that don't realize they're watching the wrong channel and somehow think they ended up on like some Kansas bias broadcast. And you did. So last thing, Scott, and then I'm going to let you get out of here. I need your official predictions, and I need you to tell me what exactly Kansas has to do to be able to cut down the nets on Monday night.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, we just beat the best team in the country. It's Duke. And I'm hard on Devontae because I expect a lot out of Devontae Graham. He's our best player, and we need him to be amazing. And he was good against Duke. He wasn't amazing. We need him to be amazing against Villanova. He's going to be playing against some upperclassmen in the guards area. And I don't think Villanova is as talented as Duke, but they are more mature and they're more precision-oriented. So it's a little different beast. They're not as talented, where we beat a more talented team. I think Duke was the best team. Now we're playing the second best team. We need a heroic effort by Devontae. We need our bigs, Udoka Azubuki and DeSosa, to be as good as they were last game. They don't need to be better, but they need to be as good. And how I mean that is by staying out of foul trouble and doing just what they did. Get some rebounds, get some good points, get some buckets. Don't be in foul trouble. Be intimidating, and slow their bigs down. That's all we needed them to do. And Svi hit a big three for us and knocked it into overtime. I'm not asking for that again. I need Devontae to do that. And if Svi does what he does and knocks down some threes, Vic is going to be there. He may have a great game. And then, of course, Newman has been amazing throughout. He's been the most consistent Jayhawk, I think, down the stretch here. Obviously, we need another big performance from him. He's got high numbers. Somebody mentioned him in the same breath with Danny Manning, but Danny's numbers were unattainable when he took him and the Miracles to the national championship in 1988. Malik's not there as far as numbers, but he has been having absolutely ridiculous numbers. So we need another heroic effort from pretty much everybody because, we don't have 10 deep to go to. If guys get in foul trouble, if guys aren't shooting threes and knocking them down for Kansas, it's not going to work. Villanova is a well-oiled machine. They've been there. They've done that. They're upperclassmen. We're not going to wow them. We're not going to surprise them. We've got to be great in order to beat that team. If Kansas gets that win, and I think they will, because Bill's got them playing on all cylinders as best as we can right now. We get that win. I think Michigan is great. And obviously Michigan is the second. I think Michigan is the second best team in the Final Four. They're behind Villanova. We're third, and Loyola Chicago is fourth. But I just love the way those Ramblers play. I want Michigan to beat them because I think Kansas has a better chance against Michigan if we get past Villanova than we do against Loyola Chicago because those Ramblers keep on rambling. It seems like they got God on their side, and those kids are just—they are sharing the ball. They pass the ball. They cover for each other on defense. I can't stop talking about the Ramblers. I love the way they play. I almost kind of, like, I want to do our game. And if Kansas, this is blasphemy right now, but if Kansas happens to lose on Saturday, I want TNT to let me do the Loyola Ramblers if they win against Michigan for the national championship game. I want to do their broadcast because I'll be all team Loyola Chicago because those kids are absolutely fun to watch. They're a blast. They play basketball the right way. They share it. They help each other on defense. They scramble for each other. No one thinks that they're better than anybody else on the team. It is absolutely fun basketball. I love watching those kids play. If Kansas doesn't win it all, I want Loyola Chicago to win it all. But obviously, my pick is Kansas. The Jayhawks take it. They get past Villanova because they have an amazing game again. And then Michigan beats Loyola, it'll be before our game on Saturday. Michigan beats Loyola because I think that we match up better with Michigan than we do with Loyola Chicago. And so there you go. There's my prediction. Kansas wins it all over Loyola Chicago.
I see that Sister Jean has already gotten you under her spell, and I like it. I am on that bandwagon as well. But Scott, listen, man, I appreciate your time. Everybody listening right now, subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast. When you're done doing that, go search Planet Pollard Podcast in iTunes and in SoundCloud. Subscribe to that, rate that, review that, tell everybody how good it is. Scott, listen, man, I appreciate the time, and I'm looking forward to hearing you on Saturday night.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for having me. And, please do, and I'll check out this podcast. And everybody, enjoy.